Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The rumor mill is spinning today in Washington that the special counsel Robert Mueller is about to submit his report on possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians. Here's the president this morning.
We'll see what happens. There was no collusion. There was no obstruction. Everybody knows it. It's all a big hoax.
Let's start there with our Friday Politics Roundtable. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter, is with us. Hi, Kelsey.
Hey there.
And Sahil Kapoor, a Bloomberg News national political reporter. Welcome.
Great to join you.
So let's start there with the Mueller report. And I admit that in a couple hours, we could be wrong, but we have been here before where people think that it's about to come out. But on the Fox Business Network this morning, Trump was asked what he's expecting. Here he is.
Well, it's always interesting to me because a deputy that didn't get any votes appoints a man that didn't get any votes. He's going to write a report on me.
Kelsey, what if this report does not implicate the president or anyone in his circle on collusion? Is it going to be a letdown for those who are waiting for some big blockbuster?
Well, I think it's going to cause Democrats, particularly in the House, to kind of rethink the way that they're framing the investigations that they're doing, both in the Judiciary Committee and the House Oversight Committee and in a number of other committees, like the Ways and Means Committee that's looking into his tax returns. They're kind of relying on the Mueller report to give them a little bit more fuel to kind of lend some public legitimacy to an investigation that many of them are afraid could be viewed as partisan. So if the Mueller report does come back and shows that there is no provable wrongdoing by mm-hmm. the president or by his staff, that just makes that much more difficult. And Democrats may have to reassess how they approach things.
Sahil, what are you expecting when it comes to the Mueller report?
Well, the two things that everyone's going to be looking out for is that does Robert Mueller have evidence that the president was involved in a conspiracy to commit a crime, in other words, coordinate with Russia to influence and manipulate the 2016 election, and did he commit obstruction of justice? Now, some other things that Democrats in Congress are going to be looking for is evidence that the president was somehow compromised, and that could mean that the Russians had information on him or even they knew that he was lying about something that, if the Russians were to reveal, would be damaging to him politically. So there are a number of different tentacles to this that Democrats are going to be looking for. But I do think Kelsey's absolutely right that this is going to be a tipping point in the way Democrats handle this. One way or another, there is a flashpoint on Capitol Hill. There's a debate among Democrats as to how speedily, how rapidly, and how quickly to pursue the president's tax returns, because that is going to be the next stage of this investigation in terms of his finances and what other things he was involved in.
Okay, we'll have a chance to talk a lot more about it once we see it, if we see it. But how about this next story? We remember that President Trump, during his campaign, made a very big deal of Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Now we're hearing from a House committee chairman that President Trump's daughter, Ivanka, has been using a private email account, and that her husband, Jared Kushner, has been using WhatsApp encrypted messages to communicate with foreign leaders while they've both been conducting official business at the White House. Kelsey, Chairman Elijah Cummings also is saying that the White House is stonewalling the committee's requests for documents from Trump insiders on all sorts of different investigations. So talk about that. Is it legal, and what happens next with all those investigations?
Well, the response from the White House has actually been more or less what we have expected. They have given every signal that while they publicly say that they're interested in complying. This is really in line with the way the White House has approached all investigations, is to question whether or not it is their responsibility to turn over documents. I don't think we should expect that Elijah Cummings will stop asking for them or that the committee will stop attempting to use whatever powers, including potentially their subpoena power, to go after information. This is not an end point. This is just the beginning of what many, many Democrats tell me could be an investigation that stretches on for years. When it comes to the question of Jared Kushner and the use of WhatsApp and the emails, his attorney, we should be clear, has said that the way that the Democrats have conveyed this is maybe misconstruing things. And I think we'll see more information on this come out over the next days and weeks.
The lawyer has, in fact, said, Kushner's lawyer has said, he did not use WhatsApp to communicate with leaders. Elijah Cummings says he did. So, again, perhaps we'll figure that out eventually.
Right. I think that is something that dispute is probably going to go on. And that actually, it goes to the point that we were making about earlier about the political side of this, is that when there are these disputes about the facts like that, it makes it more difficult for either side to claim that this is a completely nonpartisan or a kind of investigation that goes beyond politics.
Let's talk about what's going on with the late Senator John McCain. President Trump once again this morning said he's not a fan of McCain. Maria Bartiromo on Fox Business News pressed Trump on all of the comments and tweets that he's made about McCain this morning.
We would have had great health care.
But, Mr. President, he's dead. He can't punch back. I know you punch back,
no,
but he's dead.
I don't talk about it. People ask me the question. I didn't bring this up. You just brought it up.
Now, there are a handful of Republicans who have pushed back against the president. Senator Isaacson from Georgia, Senator Joni Ernst, said she didn't appreciate the tweets, that John McCain is a dear friend of hers and President Trump should stop doing what he's doing. But Sahil, explain why is this happening? Why is President Trump doing this? Who is he talking to?
The president has continued to attack John McCain in spite of what members of his party have said, in spite of the discomfort that he's seen among many Republicans. But look, this falls under the long category of things that President Trump can say or do that'll cause discomfort among Republicans, whether it's his allies on Capitol Hill or his voters around the country, but that won't cause them to abandon him. And he knows that, which is why he keeps doing it over and over again. Now, the backstory to this, of course, is that the two things the president has been going after McCain on was the fact that he received the dossier, the so-called Steele dossier or information about that early on in 2017 and passed it along to the FBI. McCain has confirmed that he did do that. And the president keeps going after John McCain for that famous thumbs down on the Senate floor that killed the Obamacare repeal effort. There's not a whole lot of love for John McCain among President Trump's core base of support, which is another reason he feels free to keep going after him.
But at the same time, Kelsey, there's a question of decency in going after not just somebody who has passed away, but also a war hero who's revered by both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, and I think that is a huge frustration for a lot of Republicans. I mean, this is the kind of thing where we talked to them about this before. This isn't the first time the president has gone after John McCain. And they will talk to us in the hallways, and Sahil has probably seen this happen as well, where they will say that it's really hard for them to be in this situation because they want the president to just stop distracting from policies, and they want him to understand that John McCain was a personal friend and somebody that they cared about very deeply. And so this is a very personal situation, and one that really, really angers Republicans, establishment Republicans, and a lot of Republican voters who feel very strongly about that McCain was a presidential candidate who many of them voted for and who they supported. And this creates a tension within the party that a lot of Republicans feel is completely unnecessary.
The president was also turning some heads this week when he tweeted that the United States should recognize Israel's control of the Golan Heights, which it's had for decades. This is just days ahead of a visit by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's facing a very tough re-election battle back at home. Netanyahu called this a miracle announcement from Trump, but let's listen to some more of that interview with Fox host Maria Bartiromo, who asked about it this morning.
This is about regional security.
It's not about Netanyahu's re-election.
No, I don't. I wouldn't even know about that. I wouldn't even know about that. I have no idea. I hear he's doing okay.
Sahil, what do you make of that? Do you agree with the president has no idea about that? And why did he do it if it wasn't to help Netanyahu?
Well, it would be a rather happy convenience for Netanyahu if the president just so happened to do this while Netanyahu is facing a very difficult re-election that's coming right up. This is something that Netanyahu has wanted. Israel, of course, seized the Golan Heights in the 1967 war and later went on to annex it. It is disputed territory, to say the least. International law does not recognize Israel's sovereignty over it. So it's quite an extraordinary step for a United States president to say that, this should be recognized as Israel's territory. This is, of course, sparked a debate that has been ongoing already inside the Democratic Party, elevated, I should say, a debate that's been ongoing inside the Democratic Party about U.S. policy toward Israel, whether America should maintain its steadfast level of support for the Jewish state if it continues policies such as moving seizing on Jerusalem and continuing its expansion of settlements and things like that. There are many progressives that are highly uncomfortable with that, and that has led several Democratic presidential candidates to snub the AIPAC convention, the pro-Israel lobby.
right next week that convention's happening.
Well, actually, Sahil, thank you for bringing us to the Democratic presidential candidates, because in the minute we have left, I want to talk about something else that's in the news. Kelsey, former Vice President Joe Biden has not announced a candidacy yet, but people expect him to do that. And there is word that if he does, that he may pledge to only seek one term to deal with concerns about his age, and that he may even choose a running mate right at the start, possibly former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. What about that?
Well, I'm hearing from Democrats who say that, you know, that they question some of those choices. Choosing to say that you will only be around for a year could create a situation where Congress doesn't take the president all that seriously if Biden were to be elected.
For a term, you mean?
Yeah, sorry, for one term. I'm sorry. Because, you know, it's essentially creating a lame duck right from the get-go. And there are also a lot of questions about choosing a running mate right away, because nobody knows who's going to be popular by the time the election rolls around.
Well, we will see, and we will keep following not just what's happening in the White House, but also those people who would like to be in the White House in a couple of years. Sahil Kapoor at Bloomberg News and Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much
for
having me.
This week, Purdue University started blocking Netflix and other popular streaming sites in all of its academic buildings. That's after some faculty complained about the network slowing to a crawl while students streamed video and games on apps like Hulu, Steam, and HBO. So how's the ban going? Let's ask one of the people behind it, Stephen Bowden, a professor of chemical engineering at Purdue. Professor, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
And at the time that Purdue decided to move forward with this policy, you were head of teaching and learning technology there, which meant you were a liaison between academic faculty and IT. What kind of things were you hearing from the IT folks about the strain that these streaming sites were putting on the network?
Well, faculty were running into problems when they were trying to use the different educational apps that we have available in the classroom. And that put a burden on the IT staff, because when the technology fails in the classroom, everything stops in the classroom. And the technology people have to sprint there, try to get everything back online, try to get everything working. And that's a real strain on everybody to try to solve these kinds of problems in real time.
Is that because students were streaming Netflix or whatever in class?
Yes, we were able to monitor sort of where was the traffic going from the different relays in the classroom. And the overwhelming majority of the high bandwidth usage was going to things like Netflix and Hulu and other sites that were not really academically focused sites.
And it brings up the issue of whether what you're doing now by blocking these sites is about your network, or it's just about getting the students to focus on learning instead of watching movies or playing games?
Well, in the classroom, I would say that myself and most of my colleagues are generally trying very hard to have the class be as engaging as possible and to keep the students focused on what we're doing from an educational perspective. But very often, these students might simply be downloading something that they're going to watch later on. It's not necessarily that they're watching the wrong thing in the class. They might be updating their iPhone operating system, for example, which takes a lot of bandwidth. So there were other uses that weren't necessarily a lack of attention, but there was also some lack of attention usage.
What have you heard from students about the idea of blocking these sites?
Crickets, to be honest with you. I haven't heard anything from the students. What they have asked about, though, is can they still have access to these kinds of sites outside the classrooms, but still in the academic buildings? So in the lounges and in the atria and other places where they might sort of relax between classes or study between classes, will it still be available there was an issue. And the answer to that is yes, it will be.
It still will be. Because I was noticing that in the Chicago Tribune, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign responded to what you're doing and said they have made significant investments in their network in order to provide the students, faculty, and staff with the technological infrastructure to support their needs. They're basically saying we just increased our bandwidth so that people can do this if they want to.
Well, we have done something similar, but at some point in time, you cannot put more relays in a confined space before they start interfering with each other. So we had already made those investments to update and upgrade the technology in the classrooms, really as far as it could be upgraded before we started to have interference kinds of problems. And we were still unable to keep up with the student demand. And on top of that, it's not too hard to imagine as we go forward and these higher and higher bandwidth kinds of applications come out, if we don't do something, we're not going to be able to keep up with that.
Do you think the students are going to find a way around your blocking of these sites?
When I first heard about this project, the first thing I said was, our students are very smart, mm-hmm. and we will lose the fight against the students if we decide we're going to out-technology them. But it does not seem to be the case that they have decided to find ways around the filtering that's going on in the classroom. Instead, they've either gone with, if they're going to not pay attention, they've decided to not pay attention with low bandwidth usage kinds of sites, or they are simply using the sites that we're trying to filter in other locations in the academic buildings where it's not a teaching setting.
Do you think other universities are going to follow your lead here?
I think it's inevitable. This generation of students probably has no recollection of any point in time where they could not be continuously connected through some sort of mobile device to their peers and to the outside world. The race to be able to provide enough technology so that they can be connected but yet still be in the classroom, we can't win that race. So at some point, we're going to have to limit what we're going to have available in the classrooms.
It'll be very interesting to see if some of them, after not being able to access these sites, decide, oh, things are actually better when I can just focus on life in front of me.
Well, that's certainly a hope. All students are at some point on a continuum from where they were when they were in high school to where they're going to be as professionals out there in the world. And I think for all of them at some point in time, focusing on the important thing that's going on in the classroom becomes the number one priority. If this helps that transition, then it's so much the better.
That is Stephen Bowden, professor of chemical engineering at Purdue University. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Okay, some TV now. ABC's The Fix premiered on Monday. It's about a white lawyer who tries to convict a charismatic black celebrity for murder. If that sounds familiar, maybe it's because Marcia Clark is behind it. She was the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson trial. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so just to be clear, this is not actually about O.J. Simpson. It just seems like it's about O.J.
It just feels that way.
It just feels that way. What do you make of it?
Well, okay, so Marcia Clark is the executive producer of this show, and it's basically about a former prosecutor named Maya Travis, not Marcia Clark, but Maya Travis, mm-hmm. who prosecuted a really famous black man for murder and botched it. And then a woman that he's involved with is found murdered, and he's believed to be the prime suspect again, and she's brought back. And we've got a clip here where they're executing a search warrant at the home of this star. And she sort of delivers her manifesto on what she wants to prove here. So let's check it out.
Anything in the pool house?
Possible traces of blood, but not a lot. I told forensics to put a rush on it.
He looks older.
He'd probably tell you the last 8 years have been tough on him. No more starring roles, living off foreign endorsements.
He killed two women and got away with it. And he still gets to live in this place. I need to make it right. If he killed Jessica, we're gonna put him away this time. We're good.
You're damn right we are.
Yeah.
So two women this time, because in the case of O.J., it was a woman and a man who he was accused of murdering.
Yeah, basically what the story does is it tries to substitute a lot of the race dialogue for a dialogue about domestic violence. Like O.J. Simpson, this star who's being prosecuted, there's suspicions that he had also perpetrated domestic violence against a woman who's his girlfriend who's found dead. And that dialogue seems to substitute a lot of the talk about race that initially affected the O.J. Simpson trial and affects how we even remember it nowadays.
Now, you say we remember it nowadays. I should point out that it happened, 25 years ago at this point. So anybody who's, in college or younger wasn't even alive during all of that stuff.
Right,
and they may not know the story.
They may not know the story, but we have had two very high-profile TV projects that have sort of gone back and retold the history of it. We had People v. O.J. Simpson on FX, and then we had a documentary on ESPN as well. The fictional retelling sort of gave us another look at Marcia Clark. It really explored some of the sexism that was inherent in how she was treated. Mm-hmm. And this character, Maya, went through something similar, and we have a clip where she talks about that. So let's check that out.
You have no idea what it felt like to be me 8 years ago.
Okay.
Was your face on the news all day, every day? Was your entire life dissected? Your hair, your clothes, every single decision, every mistake. Nobody knows your name. Nobody blames you for letting a murderer walk.
Yeah. So, you know, you can't help but feel like Marcia Clark is basically sort of yelling at the audience through this character. What's interesting to me about this and what troubles me about it is that the people of O.J. Simpson sort of showed how the prosecutors didn't understand race. And they didn't understand how the LAPD's history of brutalizing black people was going to make it tough for black people on the jury to convict a black celebrity like O.J. Simpson. And this story doesn't really engage any of those kinds of ideas. And so, of course, it's the kind of story that Marcia Clark would want to tell because in a lot of ways it kind of omits the biggest mistakes that she made as a prosecutor when she was originally trying that case.
So do you think that this show will do well for ABC?
It doesn't seem to be doing that well. The first showing didn't do great in the ratings. Ultimately, it doesn't have much of a message. And the question sort of like, why should I as a viewer kind of relive a pseudo version of, you know, a retrying of the O.J. Simpson-like character? Like, why should I put myself through watching that? Mm-hmm. I don't think the show really answers that question. And that's a really important question if you want people to stick with a show like this through multiple episodes.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
And Peter, Eric promises that the next time he comes on, he'll give us a show that we should actually watch and not one that's just okay.
Last time I spoke with him, he told me he loved Catastrophe, so I'm excited to start that one.
He always has good recommendations. I am still catching up on season 5 of Schitt's Creek, which I will say is S-C-H-I-T-T-S.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Another privacy scandal at Facebook. The company admitted this week that hundreds of millions of users had their passwords stored in plain text, making them accessible internally to about 20,000 employees. Brian Krebs, a security blogger, first broke the story Thursday when an unnamed Facebook executive contacted him with concerns that Facebook would not go public with the discovery fast enough. For more, let's go to Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for us at Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Facebook, by the way, has since confirmed much of Krebs' account. But tell us about what exactly happened and how it happened.
Yeah. So as you noted, these passwords were stored in plain text. It's really standard practice in the security world to encrypt passwords, even internally, with something called hashing and salting. Basically, what it means is that any kind of service that requires passwords usually disguises those passwords as other numbers and letters. So even an employee with special privileges can't actually see the password itself. Obviously, in this case, that didn't happen. And many people in the tech and security world would call that a rookie mistake, which is why I think it's surprising that it happened at a company the size of Facebook.
And Facebook is saying that passwords were never visible to anyone outside of Facebook or abused by employees. How can we believe such a thing?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, this is kind of like the bank realizing it left the front door and the vault door wide open for 7 years, but they haven't seen any evidence of looting or missing money. And of course, a smart thief wouldn't make a mess. So I'd say the jury is still out on this, at least until Facebook concludes its investigation. Now, Brian Krebs, who you mentioned, the security journalist and researcher who we should definitely hat tip for writing about this before Facebook even announced it, reported that 2,000 2,000 employees had made 9 million data requests over time that included the plain text passwords. Now, that's enough repeated access, I think, to give the company a lot to be concerned about.
Should users of Facebook change their passwords now just to be safe?
Yeah, I would say. You know, Facebook is not asking users to change their passwords, but I would say, why not? Change your password. Couldn't hurt.
Now, when you look at Facebook's stock, after all of these privacy scandals, it's still, it's not as high as it's ever been, but it's close right now. Why does nothing seem to hurt Facebook?
I just can't quit you, Facebook. I know. It's something that I think says a lot about the way that we exist in the world today on our devices. We continue to be flabbergasted by how these services treat us, whether that's mining our data to leverage it for selling advertisements or failing to protect our personal information. And I think in some ways, because these services are free, you know, we just kind of take it and accept it as part of the new reality of our existence on our devices and the services we use. I do think over time, the pattern is going to change there, and people are going to start dipping away from social media as just like putting their information and their thoughts and feelings out publicly and start creating smaller groups. And I think that's already happening with chat apps and things like that. So I do think that users are changing over time, but I think you're right. We're all addicted to the service, at least for now.
And Facebook's plan, if I remember correctly from a story I did about a week ago, is to create a new Facebook that has smaller groups that you don't share things as widely. So maybe we'll still be using Facebook. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
School counselors are having a tough time keeping up with a wave of new struggles among American teenagers. Over the past decade, the number of young people reporting symptoms of major depression has increased by more than 50% among 12 to 17-year-olds. That's according to a study published this month in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. So, more kids need to speak with a counselor, but it's unlikely to happen at school, where resources are getting stretched thinner and thinner. Amanda Novak has an idea to fix this problem. She's the assistant principal at Westgate Community School, a K-12 public charter in Thornton, Colorado. She's helped launch a program to train 18 students as peer mentors to meet the demand for school counselors. Amanda, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's nice to be here.
And we've also got Peyton Meredith, a Westgate senior and one of the student peer counselors. Peyton, good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you as well.
Great. Amanda, let's start with you. How stretched thin did you get before you realized that you needed your students to help you with this problem?
It started when I started at Westgate. We are, as you mentioned, a K-12. We have about 510 students. And kindergartners all the way to seniors in high school, there's a lot of needs there. And we have one counselor for our entire student body. And we noticed right away just that our counselor was like running around all day long, just trying to meet with kid after kid after kid. She was literally just running around the building all day.
And what kind of fires was she putting out?
Students that needed to talk to somebody. So if a student had a death in the family, or if their dog was sick, or if they just were tired and needed a minute, teachers sometimes don't have the ability to support a student in that moment. And so the counselor was getting requests all day long just to check in with these students. And the counselor also has a caseload of students that she sees regularly for some more serious things. And so between those two sort of items, she was running around all the time.
So what you're describing is happening across the board. The American School Counselor Association says on average there is one counselor for every 444 students in this country, when it should be closer to one for every 250 students. I just wonder what you think the results of something like that are.
It's what you're seeing. We're seeing kids in crisis, and counselors have a lot of jobs too. So kids with suicidal ideation and kids with depression and kids with anxiety and kids with impulsivity issues. And I think that if we had more counselors, you know, we could support more, 1 to 200, like you said.
Well, and as we said, mental health problems are getting worse. What do you think is making it so tough for kids these days?
a few components. First of all, I think there's a lot of pressure on students right now to succeed. And it's a really fast-paced society, so we have like less time for reflection, for processing, for relationship. And then there's also technology right now. I think that technology has an impact on those things, and I think that's all creating this problem.
Okay, so you came up with a new idea. Get the students to help you. Get students like Peyton to help you deal with this problem. Tell me about what you've done.
I think it started by just talking to a group of ambitious high schoolers that sort of saw this problem too. They saw their friends feeling the stress of school and the stress of work and all the things that students have to do every day. And then they also noticed that, you know, in our building, we have young students faced with the same problems. And it kind of just was born out of that conversation. Mm. And as with a social work background, I've studied counseling. I've read a lot of Brené Brown and just how to support people in this way. And I thought I could probably teach students how to do that in a way that still, you know, values student privacy and confidentiality and the system we have without sort of impeding that. We could still support more people that way.
Peyton Meredith, this is where you come in. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so tell me how this works. You know, maybe you could just go through one of the recent mediations that you had with a classmate.
So little kids nowadays have, the news is more open and there's so much happening in the world and it's at their fingertips. First and second graders are seeing these like mass shootings and stuff and want to know why this is happening. And they come scared, like, am I going to be okay? Am I going to be okay? And we're like, it's hard to explain to them that yes, they will be okay.
That's got to be tough. So tell me about, you know, these conversations that you're having with a little kid who comes up to you asking those questions. How do you make them feel better?
I just tell them, like, it's always happened. We just have so much technology at our fingertips now that it's recorded more. It's more known because we're more connected than we've ever been as a society in general.
What about the older kids? Can you tell me about a problem that one of the high schoolers has come to you for?
The high schoolers have come to me because they're so stressed. There's so much pressure put on them, especially as they enter junior and senior year of now you have to make a life choice of where are you going to go next? And a lot of them is, I don't know until I'm actually in the workforce. But my parents are forcing me to figure out something that I'm not ready to figure out because I'm not ready to grow up yet.
And what do you do? I mean, again, how do you help them? Do you think that you can offer them something different because they're looking at someone that's the same age as them and not a teacher, not an adult?
How I help them is just letting them talk because they have the solutions themselves. They just don't know until they say it out loud, until they have someone to bounce ideas off and the correct kind of question them in a safe manner that's not destructive or harmful or judgy. It's just like a bounce off session and they ultimately have the solutions. It's just they need to organize their thoughts to get to that solution.
What if someone came up to you and said, Peyton, I'm thinking about suicide? What would you do?
That one is not for me to handle. I have to go straight to my counselor or Ms. Novak because that is out of my range as I have not been taught how to deal with that. That's an adult problem that I cannot face.
Sure. And Amanda Novak, what do you think about that? Are you at all concerned that in some iteration of these conversations that Peyton is having, that she may be carrying a heavy weight on her, that someone might come to her for an issue that a trained professional should be dealing with?
Yeah. And it's happened before. And our mentors have role played and practiced how to like gently pause that session and go get either myself or the counselor. But then we always have an opportunity at the end of our sessions to work as a team of peer mentors to go through self-care, to get support, to make sure that we're filling our own cups and taking care of ourselves.
So it sounds like you do a lot of training before any of these peer mentors ever see another student.
Significantly. We do a significant amount of training and throughout the process.
But to be clear, you're also relying on a teenage volunteer to do the work that the state and that school districts have traditionally paid for. I mean, do you think that your fix is the right long-term solution to this problem we've been talking about?
I think that every student has social-emotional needs in school that are simply not being met because we're more focused on academic standards right now as a culture. I don't, you know, that bleeds into mental health, I think, because you're looking at students have who have maybe like a mid-level need. When they don't get support, when they don't get mental health support, and they don't have the support of a counselor quickly or even ever throughout the school year, that mid-level concern can become a crisis. And that's where the problem lies. So if we have a group of high schoolers, compassionate, empathetic, trained high schoolers who are just that space to like talk to or someone can have a supportive presence, what we're doing is we're taking away that cycle where it becomes a crisis because nobody has reached out to that person.
Peyton, what do you think? Are you making a difference?
I know I'm making a difference because I've seen the difference I've made in the kids I've mentored. Their whole mentality changes towards school, towards life, towards themselves, which is what a kid needs at times.
What about how it makes you feel?
It makes me feel like I had have a purpose in the education system that many students don't realize they have.
And I'm just asking that question because I'm guessing that maybe you can relate to some of the problems that these young people are coming to you with. I mean, you're about to go off to college. I'm sure you feel the pressures of doing well in school and getting a job and being an adult.
Yeah, because before I came to Westgate, I never knew who like to talk to if something happened. I was just kind of by myself and with three friends who were not mature enough to handle problems. But coming to Westgate and having that program allowed me to choose and have people to support me and help me with little issues before they became huge issues. So if I can do that to a few kids, it can change the whole world for them.
Peyton Meredith, a student peer counselor at Westgate Community School in Thornton, Colorado, and Amanda Novak, the assistant principal at the school who's running this peer counseling program. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
Thank you as well.
Late last year, we featured a story about a 15-year-old boy from El Salvador who'd traveled 2,000 miles to the U.S. border with Mexico. He was staying at a youth shelter in Tijuana, and he planned to ask U.S. officials for asylum in a bid to be reunited with his mother, who was in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, after months of anxiety, they are finally together. Farida Jabvala Romero from member station KQED caught up with them.
Veronica Aguilar pushes a supermarket cart at a discount grocery store in the city of Penol. She grabs a bag of beans from the shelf and turns to her son Vladimir, who trails closely behind. She asked us to not disclose his last name because she fears it could hurt his immigration case.
See? Él es feliz con frijoles.
Not too long ago, something as routine as a grocery trip together seemed like a dream for Aguilar and her son. They were separated more than a year by international borders. Aguilar was the first to flee death threats in El Salvador in 2017. Then last year, Vladimir also ran away from gang members with guns drawn at his doorstep. Now that he's with her, she says she's so happy that she can take care of him.
Pues me siento muy feliz de que ya esté conmigo, de tenerlo de nuevo cerca de mí, de poder cuidar de él.
For Vladimir, this place is brand new. His first 2 months in the U.S. were at a government-run shelter in Florida. He was just released in early February. But he says being here with his mom feels bittersweet because he misses his grandmother, who's like a mother to him.
Me siento triste porque estoy lejos ya de mi abuela, que ella es como una madre.
The grandmother traveled through Mexico by foot and car with Vladimir to drop him off safely at the U.S. border. She then had to return to El Salvador to care for her other grandkids. Vladimir found himself alone at a contentious time in Tijuana. He was part of a wave of thousands of Central American migrants who arrived in that border city last November and waited for their turn to ask U.S. officials for asylum. And that's when Vladimir met two American women who would make his journey to California possible. At a youth shelter where he was staying, he met a pro bono lawyer who said she could help him. A few days later, they jumped in a cab and headed to a nearby border crossing. The lawyer then pleaded with a U.S. Customs and Border Protection supervisor there to process Vladimir for asylum. Lindsay Toslowski directs the Immigrant Defenders Law Center in Los Angeles. She says the supervisor kept telling them their facilities were at capacity and they couldn't take Vladimir.
You know, telling us that we needed to vacate the premises and that, you know, we would get in trouble if we continued to loiter there.
But then Tozlowski says Vladimir had a stroke of luck. Another woman who'd been standing there walked up and asked the Customs and Border Protection supervisor what he meant by at capacity.
And the CBP supervisor said, ma'am, you need to step back. You know, I don't need to answer that question. You need to back up. And she said, no, I am a member of Congress. And in fact, you do need to answer that question because we fund your agency.
Turns out that was Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, who was on a tour of the border to speak with migrants. The CBP supervisor ended up relenting and accepted Vladimir for processing. Tozlowski gave Vladimir a hug and said goodbye. At home in the Bay Area, Aguilar and Vladimir put away their groceries. He says he doesn't want to talk about his experience while under government custody, including the months he spent in the Florida shelter after he requested asylum. But his mom says when she would talk to him on the phone, he was depressed. Now she sees a pain inside him.
Yo no quiero que él como joven vaya a vivir con eso toda su vida.
She says he's young and she doesn't want him to live with that his whole life. She wants to find a psychologist he can talk to.
Sí, a ver qué pasa.
Through it all, Aguilar has been amazed by the generosity of strangers. She says the married couple who opened up their home to her months ago and who've now taken in Vladimir have supported her like family.
Somos una familia que me han ayudado, me han apoyado.
On the day I visit, Aguilar gets an unexpected present in the mail. It's a $100 gift card from a professor in Southern California who heard about them. There's also a note.
Vladi, bienvenido a los Estados Unidos. Fue un viaje largo y difícil.
Yo llegué. The professor says she's also an immigrant who came here looking for a better life. She tells them everything is possible. Good luck.
Todo se puede. Buena suerte.
Aguilar puts the note back in the envelope and looks up at her son.
Entonces es motiva para seguir luchando, porque sí se puede.
She says it's motivation to keep fighting. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.